it, the nameless fear, or war of the weird, a harmless art presentation, copyright 1991 by James Beatty. Originally published in the Lyceum 23 book, Desire is Illusion, which was mainly distributed at ComFest 1991. It has often been said that everyone who exists is a member of the free-form performance group known as Lyceum 23. Some people believe it, and some don't. It totally ceased to matter, in any case, on the day Earth was finally invaded from the planet Mars. It is true, of course, that Mars was uninhabited and had been for millennia, since the mysterious builders of the Martian Sphinx had all died or departed. But it turned out that the Sphinx was the site of a gate to another dimension, presided over by an other-dimensional entity called a Zoni. The gate had recently been opened from Earth by a deranged Lovecraftian scholar and occultist, an artist and poet obsessed with Mars, who had opened the gate unintentionally while playing with a copy of the fabled, forbidden Necronomicon. It was an accident, he became fond of telling himself shortly before the end. And that was true. He had simply been trying, by means of a painting he was creating, to link the Martian Sphinx with Stonehenge and the Easter Island heads, along with various other real elements which Howard Phillips Lovecraft had thrown into his stories to add a touch of verisimilitude to what was otherwise pure fantasy. The artist was obsessed with Lovecraft as well as Mars. His fondest wish was to become a contributor to the fabled Cthulhu mythos, the cycle of eldritch, other-dimensional horror stories begun in the 30s in Weird Tales magazine by H.P. Lovecraft and continued by other writers. But instead, the artist had become a part of the mythos. He had virtually painted his way right out of the Einsteinian space-time continuum of consensus reality, becoming a true outsider artist at last. It wasn't the first time, though, that Mars had been linked to the mythos, to the tales of the old ones and their extraterrestrial dimension. The artist firmly believed that the cult classic science fiction novel Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein was actually a thinly disguised Lovecraftian satire in which the humanoid Martian spy, Smith, could be related to Nyarlathotep, Lovecraft's messenger of the old ones. Certainly, the orgies of free love described in Heinlein's book bore a grim and sardonic resemblance of sorts to the grisly events which were about to take place. It was, at any rate, through the newly opened Martian gate that the old ones issued forth to assume the task of clearing the Earth for whatever kinds of reasons they had. These beings would be hard to describe in terms of our dimensional plane. Chief amongst them was Yog-Sothoth, whom Lovecraft had always described as a congeries of iridescent bubbles. But Lovecraft neglected to mention that the bubbles looked and smelled like the kind made by ripe, raunchy, underwater farts towards the end of a long and grimy bath. Their hue was a color out of space. Actually, Yog-Sothoth, sometimes known as the One in All, was one of the better looking of the elder gods by human standards. It was, of course, possible for the old ones to look any way they wanted to, just as it was possible for them to travel instantaneously through sidereal space without using any kind of a ship. But in the end, a spaceship would become part of their master plan. It was the plan of these creatures to scare and disgust us into an emotional state of helpless slime and jelly before killing and consuming us. They were highly and strangely vampiric in nature. It was among their goals to drink or grok the essence of our fear, which they thought of as the water of life and regarded as a gourmet delicacy. In other words, their invasion of Earth was not unlike a trip to 7-Eleven for a cold six-pack. It wasn't, however, mere fear alone that the invaders wanted. They wanted us to manifest repulsion as well, mixed with vague guilt and self-disgust, and also a large dose of sexual loathing. These esoteric ingredients, in proper proportions, would sweeten their brew. It was true, of course, that their primary goal was to get rid of us, to clear the earth, as Lovecraft had put it. But there was no law in the universe, natural or otherwise, to prevent them from enjoying themselves in the process, mixing business with pleasure, having a good time wiping us out. They merely lusted after the perks of genocide. It was a snap for the quasi-Martians to implement their plan. They could exert powerful and effortless control over virtually everything in reality. They could, for example, have set off the bombs themselves, but having us be responsible for that outrage was another semi-crucial ingredient for their weird, empathic concoction, sort of on the order of nutmeg. What they did do with their vast power was to bring all the dead people on Earth back to life, or at least to a state of lifelike reanimation, just like in the old sci-fi horror film Plan 9 from Outer Space. But instead of doing whatever director Edward D. Wood Jr.'s inept actors were supposed to be doing in that much maligned movie, the old ones' newly resurrected zombie hordes were sent out across the earth to engage in a mass orgy of sickening rapine and sexual plunder practiced upon a populace who could, for the most part, only view this necrophiliac form of rape with the utmost horror and revulsion. Meanwhile, the feelings and sensations of those few perverse living humans equipped to actually enjoy the situation comprised yet another bizarre cooking ingredient, like using just a dash or smidgen of rabid filth to season an otherwise wholesome broth. It would be criminal to more than suggest the unspeakable horror and hellish awfulness of the chaos which then ensued, as all over the planet, men, women, children, and even animals were subjected to unthinkable acts of sexual molestation by the rotting legions of ghastly and horny walking corpses. Acts of sodomy were commonplace, as were various types of fellatio, cunnilingus, anal oral sex, missionary sex, coprophilia, coprophagia, sadism, masochism, sadomasochism, and even mutual masturbation, sort of mutual anyway. Needless to say, the assailants could not be reasoned with, but worse than that, they were oblivious to pain, except the masochists, and could not be killed, though in some cases a putrefying pecker would come right off inside of somebody's aching asshole, or a rotting set of labia would suddenly give way and engulf someone's entire head with a sickening squish. But even then, the fun went on and on anyway, without anybody achieving orgasm. It went on, in fact, until the bodies of the posthumous rapists collapsed into mulch. It was hardest, of course, on the children, let alone the dumb animals who couldn't be expected to understand any of this. The only ray of sunshine involved was that only a few people actually met up with any of their deceased relatives, and then only by chance. Thus, one of our strongest social taboos was left, for the most part, intact. The perpetrators of this nightmare had overlooked incest, not realizing how strongly we all felt about it. But then, to the old ones, we were all relatives anyway. It was at the very height of the madness, when our fear and loathing had reached its peak, that the invaders from Mars focused their attention on Washington, D.C., causing a psionically fabricated illusion of a huge and menacing flying saucer to appear to be hovering right outside the White House. The President and Vice President were barricaded in the Oval Office, cringing around in armor-plated chastity belts and listening to Secret Service personnel being gang-raped out in the hall. The helpless, agonized shrieks of those unfortunates caused the Vice President to quiver and quail and, eventually, to shit in his pants, staining the floor with a runny brown puddle. The President was gibbering about naked aggression when he chanced to glance out the window. One sight of the clearly invincible spaceship hovering out there, as godlike as a burning bush, caused the President's heart to flutter and then to stop for good. The wimp factor had killed him at last. His last coherent thought was, "This is not about oil." It was now the Vice President's turn to loudly exclaim things like, "I'm in charge here," and "Bullets won't stop them." A former draft dodger with limited intelligence who refused to rule out the use of nuclear weapons, he lost no time in not ruling them out now. It wasn't long before the bombs were bursting in air, on the ground, and at sea, all over the world. The imaginary warships projected by the invaders drew fire like shit draws flies. Everyone died in the fallout as the mushrooms sprouted like a man-made fungus. It was then that the Martian old ones grokked their vile potion, which was now heated to just the right temperature. The hard radiation added extra savor and gusto. "It really is too bad about all this," mumbled the artist, pawn of the old ones, who had kept him alive to witness the apocalypse and were planning to consume him for dessert. "It really was too bad, too, for the human race, anyway. But it wasn't like the end of the world or anything. It was actually just the most spectacular Lyceum 23 event on record." It was a shame, however, that the artist was too frightened and distracted to fully appreciate that fact, because it didn't matter in the least to the old ones, nor was there anyone else left around for it to matter to. A little commentary here on the part of Goblinhood, a little post-story editorial comment. Biotti did a pretty good job on this. It's difficult to tell from a reading, but every single paragraph begins with the word "it." Very funny, right? Biotti made at least one serious mistake in this little opus of his. He attributed to Lovecraft the description of Yog-Sothoth as a congeries of bubbles. Actually, the only time that in all of my reading, the only time I've been able to find a statement by Lovecraft as to what Yog-Sothoth looked like was in a Lovecraft collaboration or ghostwriting piece with, I believe, Hazel Held, called "The Horror in the Museum." And then he described Yog-Sothoth, if I'm not mistaken, as a congeries of iridescent spheres, which is how August Derleth later characterized the monster in some of the stories he wrote, supposedly in collaboration with Lovecraft. Interestingly, a congeries of bubbles was what Lovecraft used to describe the dream form of the witch woman. What was her name? I forget. Who ran around with Brown Jenkin in the story Dreams in the Witch House. She was described, Keziah Mason, she was described as a congeries of bubbles in the dream, whereas Brown Jenkin was like a little polychromatic tetrahedron or something, you know? I don't remember what Nyarlathotep looked like in the dream. In the role-playing game of Lovecraft by Sandy Peterson, Yog-Sothoth is identified as a wizard's kind of elder god. In other words, one that wizards and witches can call upon. And in fact, in the Dunwich Horror, that is strongly suggested by the Whately matter. So perhaps there's a connection between Keziah Mason and Yog-Sothoth. The only other description involving bubbles in Lovecraft is in the description of the Shoggoths in At the Mountains of Madness. They're big protoplasmic balls of slime that can create whatever sort of like limbs and sensory organs they want, and they seem to have a connection to bubbles. Biotti would like to be able to say that Yog-Sothoth is basically just a big Shoggoth to begin with, but that's kind of simplifying things a little bit. Goblinhood again. As a matter of fact, I've located a note that Biotti made quite some time ago on this very subject, and it says here, "After exhaustive research, This story has yielded the only solid description I've found by HPL himself of his monster god, Yog-Sothoth. Quote, imagination called up the shocking form of fabulous Yog-Sothoth, only a congeries of iridescent globes, yet stupendous in its malign suggestiveness. Unquote. This describes a waxwork of Yog and must be the source of Derleth's latter collaborative, so-called collaborative descriptions. That's also part of Viotti's notes. And the beginning of this is like really interesting, especially when you consider the freedom of expression connotations of that story. It kind of shocks me at this point that that was distributed. I think it was, cost $1 a copy at the ComFest, where it would have been possible for children to get a hold of a copy, perhaps. I wasn't selling them, you know. It also included my poem, Rabbit Tobacco, which was almost as disgusting as the story. But in that same story, the horror in the museum, there's something that Viotti has quoted extensively. And here I'm quoting it from the note that he made. H.P. Lovecraft speaks out on freedom of expression. And the rest of this is from the story itself. Jones lowered the photograph in disgust and pity. See here, Rogers, this won't do. There are limits, you know. It's a great piece of work and all that, but it isn't good for you. Better not see it anymore. Let Orabona break it up and try to forget about it. And let me tear this beastly picture up, too. And that's the end of the quote. It's from The Horror in the Museum, 1932, ghostwritten collaboratively for Hazel Held by HPL. Quoted from the 1989 Arkham House edition of the collection, The Horror in the Museum. Synopsis: an art enthusiast, Jones, is repulsed by a photo of the monster Ran Tegoth, supposedly modeled in wax by the mad sculptor Rogers and his reluctant assistant Orabona. Okay. Other things about the War of the Weird, or It, the Nameless Fear, or whatever you want to call it. The story was published in 1991, and it's extremely topical. The president and the vice president, for instance, are very thinly disguised versions of George Bush and Dan Quayle, so that their comments, such as "this is not about oil" and "not ruling out, you know, nuclear weapons," those are like from the real people. Naked aggression, that's what Bush called the war against Kuwait and Iraq. And the story was written shortly after all that, so everybody at the time who read the story knew what it was talking about. Viotti has written more extensively about what he considers to be the Heinlein, you know, satire on Lovecraftian stuff. It would suffice here to say that Heinlein called his Martians old ones. He barely described them at all. And his character Smith really was a half-Martian, half-human spy for them. And he really did do pretty much what Nyarlathotep would do if he came to Earth, which was to spread a lot of chaos and particularly moral chaos around. But anyway, let me go on. I'm going to read some stuff here from Viotti's Americana, that notable little art newsletter that Viotti was playing around with a while back. With any luck, I can get the scuzzier junk on this side of the tape so that the other side of the tape can be a kind of a "see here, Rogers, this won't do" reaction, made up of like less toxic sorts of stories. This first one is from B. Biotti's Americana, Volume 1, Number 12. The headline of that issue was Hard Rock Hells and Thought Crimes for the Dream Police. And in big, bold letters, mature adults only. As with most of the stories, this one took place in a dream. And the date given is the date of the dream, which probably was like right around the same time the thing was published in 1990. Copyright 1990 by James Biotti. It's got a heading, Dream Sleaze. And the story is entitled War Hogs, respectfully dedicated to George Orwell for 1984 and to David Bowie for Diamond Dogs. And it's dated February 4th, 1990. Part 1, The Bust. I suppose it had to happen sooner or later. I'd been hoping, of course, that it would be later, but no. I lived in the basement of a huge, rambling old mansion. I lived with 12 others in the basement, but there were hundreds living in the house. It was a pop house. I had no way of knowing that when I moved in, but that's what it was. A pop house was like the place in George Orwell's 1984, the room over the store that was owned and operated by the Thought Police. Only here in reality, we didn't call them that. We just called them War Hogs. This name became popular after it became obvious to the rest of us that the drug war was in fact just a way for the pigs to keep a war going on all the time. A civil war, one where they could make up the rules as they went along. There was, of course, a real struggle going on, but it was not a society struggle to become drug-free. Else why put one of the biggest alleged drug dealers in the White House? No, the struggle was just a kind of Miami Vice shootout on the highest level across our country and our hemisphere. The big pigs were cutting each other's throats to see who would get to go to jail and who would get to be the incumbent drug czar. After troop reductions in Europe caused the army to become very interested in helping the drug lords fight over power, we all just started calling the whole rotten bunch of them war hogs, playing drug war, neutralizing their enemies and their business competition, like Al Capone wearing a badge, carrying a good citizenship award. There was big bucks and dope pushing, plus it kept the poor people reduced to the perpetual status of a new criminal class. And certain crack houses got popped, and certain others didn't. But all the pop houses got popped sooner or later. Anyway, we were all sleeping on the floor in the basement, with rats scurrying over us when the bust came down. The Hogs, short for War Hogs, kicked the door down and came in with guns blazing. Nobody was actually shot. They just wanted to look dramatic on the news. As for evidence, now that they'd shot holes in the walls, you could see white powder trickling out the holes. Oh, the walls were supposed to be filled with coke or heroin. I get it. This is a pop house. Right. Actually, the stuff was just some sort of taco flour, but that wouldn't show up on TV. Nobody really cared anyway. There was no trial. In a total drug war, they had the right to summary execution or imprisonment. As they lined us up for our tattoos, it became clear we were headed for the pokey. The tattooing hurt, but didn't last long. The mark was red and black, the four suits in a deck of cards, clubs, hearts, spades, and diamonds. A hog standing by explained it to me with a leer and a smirk. It means you'll be playing cards for a long time, playing for cigarettes, blowjobs, and each other's asses. Part 2, the Zeta connection. Oddly, all that didn't happen to me. I didn't go on to the years of boredom and buggery that my friends seemed destined for. Though I was processed with them, I was soon cut out from the herd and taken to special care detention. They said this was because I was crazy, but I knew what it really was. They were going to brainwash me. This was all about my little publication, of course, my grubby little arts newsletter. They didn't like what I was saying with it now, but they figured I could be persuaded to go back to writing nice letters to the president. Not that anybody cared, but the Hwags figured me for a public relations victory on the subject of rehabilitation. Not that anybody really cared. Anyway, they started with lights and subtle subsonic noises, all routine stuff. Before long, I had a pure headache from the neck up and was begging for a painkiller of any kind. Obligingly, they gave me a little blue pill. I knew what it was. I'd had it before, experimentally, and I knew what it could do. This was the stuff the Hwags gave each other when they wanted an operative to spill our own secrets or break our own laws. But it was their ballpark. I took the treazinol. It wasn't so bad this time. I guess it must have been cut with taco flour or something. But at any rate, it simply put me into a mellow, receptive frame of mind to further mess up my head. A female Hwag, very attractive, and dressed in slinky clothes, came in and sat on my lap, blowing in my ear, blowing my mind. Soon as she was jerking me off, the lights went out and a big screen came on with film. It was a science fiction film, I guess, though I was too mind-boggled and distracted to pay much attention to it. The Hwag lady was blowing me now. A voice-over narrator explained things, while the action on the screen seemed to depict the history of the universe from a scientific point of view or something, I guess. I couldn't be sure of anything because of the treazinol's effects. Besides, my slinky companion had her pants off now, and she was sitting on my stiff cock, squirming around, sliding her soft ass up and down on me. I was going to come soon. Vaguely, I noticed that the film had reached some point in the very early history of civilization. I think they were talking about Atlantis. "But then," said the narrator, "a cosmic event changed human affairs irrevocably. This was the sudden explosion of a distant galaxy called Zeta Aurigae." The room filled with blinding light. My head felt like it might be exploding as, without warning, the treazinol came on big time. Reflexively, I shot my load up the Hwag's shithole, and I probably shit my pants at the same time. My mind was melting, my jaw fell slackly open, and I could feel myself drooling as the galactic explosion unfolded on the screen. The lights, the treazinol. Oh Christ, it's the light doing it. That was my last coherent thought as the leering Hwag jabbed a needle into my arm. Part 3. Mad Dogs and War Hogs. I was at the supermarket. I was in the middle of a strange moral dilemma. The supermarket had a rule. You could bring your dogs in, but only if they weren't foaming at the mouth. It sounds simple enough, I guess, but of late, I've been having lots of trouble figuring even simple things out. I didn't even have a dog, but a dog had followed me there, a big Doberman. He wasn't foaming at the mouth, so I felt obliged to take him in with me. But later, when we got inside, this strange dog began copiously foaming, pouring whole buckets of rabid foam out of his stupid fucking mouth. I tried to hold his muzzle shut, but it was no good. The foam dripped between my fingers. There was nothing to do except take the slobbering mongrel outside. An oddly familiar store clerk helped me do this. The guy was pretty friendly, but seemed to be watching me closely. As we gave the pooch the old heave-ho, I explained, "It wasn't even my dog, anyway." The clerk laughed and offered me a hit off the joint that he was covertly toking on. I sucked on the thing furtively as we went back in. Most of the guy's fellow workers were clustered around reading a newspaper article. "How do you get away with this?" I wondered, meaning the dope. He grinned and assured me it was all right. "Unless you happen to be foaming at the mouth." At this he laughed heartily. I guess he was right. His boss ignored the roach and even handed over that newspaper they'd all been gawking at. My friend handed it to me, saying, "Have you seen this?" As I took the paper, I noticed for the first time a strange bald patch on my arm, as if a piece of skin had been removed. "When did that happen?" I wondered, through the dopey fog of thought. The newspaper article made me kind of sad. Another political scandal, another progressive and liberal politician had been caught with his dick up somebody's ass and his head full of unauthorized treasonol. This guy had actually voted several times against the implementation of repressive drug war policies, but now he was finished. The clerk seemed casual as he lit another doobie, but I could tell that he was watching me very closely. I wondered where I'd seen him before. Somehow, he reminded me of cards. "Don't you want to take the article with you and write one of your sneering editorial diatribes against the government for your newsletter?" he asked casually, passing the reefer. The newsletter. I thought about it. What was I doing with the newsletter these days? "I probably won't have space for that," I coughed out explosively with the smoke. "I need all 4 pages for a movie review. I want to talk about this great piece of ass I got while I was watching some sci-fi epic about Atlantis or something. I think there may have been a space war and some whole galaxy got nuked or something." Why did this fractured memory make me feel so uncomfortable? "I'd like to read that," he beamed. "What was the movie called?" "I think it was called War Hogs." Note from Goblin Hood. There are certain references in here that might be best cleared up a little bit. The commentary on the drug war, I mean, runs throughout the entire newsletter. It's like a recurrent theme. At least one of the next stories I read is going to also deal with it strongly, the Scrambler Zone trilogy, but perhaps not quite so offensively. The idea of the biggest drug lords being in the White House has to do with the Iran-Contra situation, in which the CIA was supposedly helping with South American drug or Central American drug deals, and the Panamanian dictator Noriega was one of their people. In fact, he and George Bush worked together supposedly closely. At the time this story was written, Bush had declared war on Panama, and Noriega had been arrested, and one of the things going on was he'd been holed up in his little, you know, his little stronghold with the army outside playing loud, annoying rock and roll music trying to drive him crazy. And when they finally went in after him, they supposedly found a bunch of cocaine there, and it turned out to be taco flour. All of this was on the news. He was calling Bush some sort of a coward and a double crosser or something, implying that they had some kind of a deal going on. I'm not saying that it's true. I'm just saying that at the time this story was written, that was the sort of like emotional backdrop that more or less held sway the whole idea of a drug war. This story probably talks more elaborately about my impression of it than any of the other stuff. And it wasn't entirely my idea that somehow the army kind of wanted this stuff to be an ongoing action, because like when the Soviet Union folded up, and this is like from real history, when the Soviet Union folded up, there was like no place for the army to like put its funding and stuff, you know. So in other words, their funding was like on the way out if they couldn't figure out a new threat, and the drug war gave them an excuse to like pretty much make war on the citizens of this country. This is an extreme simplification. I know that there were serious problems and so forth, and it would be a lot easier to believe in the vicious drug lords out there if there weren't these recurrent stories of the CIA being involved in some of that stuff, helping with some of these deals in order for other things to take place. Then there's also the fact that you've got Colombia, which is like basically a very poor country, and its biggest cash crop is coca leaves. What are they supposed to do? Our solution as a nation, rather than subsidizing them to grow something else, seems to have been to just like, you know, subsidize certain of them to fight against the drug lords, and then we get to sit back and just hope that we aren't, as a, you know, that we aren't clandestinely simply taking over the business for reasons of our own. Which is all pretty, you know, cynical, I admit. And the term cynical barely scratches the surface in terms of like this newsletter of Biotti's. The Dream refers to it, and he had started out trying to do a very, you know, respectful and respectable little compilation of like weird articles and so forth, you know, back in 1989 when he started it. And it very soon degenerated to the point where every other issue of the thing was some kind of like sleaze fest, including this issue and the maximum sleaze issue that came shortly after. There's a kind of, if you read all of this stuff, there's a kind of like a sense of recurrent futility and hopelessness and desperation and just plain despair, where in which he gives up and realizes nobody cares about anything, and so he might as well go ahead and like spit out whatever's on his mind. In some respects, one thing I've learned over the years, basically since Biotti started doing this newsletter, during the course of which Goblin Hood's new mask was created and then bragged about in one of the issues, in the course of this, the one thing I've learned is that true freedom of expression can only exist in a vacuum. In other words, when there are no other opinions, you can basically feel free to say or create whatever you want without other opinions deforming what you're doing. And that's why I've gone to so much trouble with this microphone and this tape recorder to create a soundscape of like readings and so forth that would encourage Biotti to do what he's doing with the paintings, as opposed to like leaving any question in his mind. Because the desire to express freely what you really think is, in some people, a very fragile thing. And this is all we've learned. We've learned that in terms of freedom of expression, the stuff that's most important to support is the stuff that you detest the most. You know, because it's that freedom that's always at stake, somebody else's. If you don't support theirs, you lose yours. And it's kind of like a quandary. But again, we've also learned that the best way to do it is when nobody's watching, listening, commenting, or anything else. Biotti wouldn't be working on his triptych that he's got going right now if he hadn't learned that he doesn't want most people to know about it until it's finished enough to be kind of a fait accompli, or at least finished enough so that they can see where he's going with it, as if that's going to make any difference. Right now I'm letting the tape run out on this side of the tape so that the stuff on the other side can all be, you know, kind of complete. Surprising how much easier it is to ramble on for Goblinhood when he's dealing with Biotti's work, which amounts to his own work. The following dream took place on a Monday, the 22nd of August, 1988, at 3 p.m., or that's when Biotti woke up. It's from Biotti's Americana, Volume 1, Number 5, copyright 1990 by James Biotti. The Scrambler Zone Trilogy, read by Goblinhood. 1. The Scrambler Zone. We were kids again, my brother and I. We went to a nearby amusement park with our father. There was some kind of special rides deal for children under a certain age. My younger brother, Bra, was under that age and so qualified for the special free rides. What Bra wanted was to ride the Scrambler all day long. The Scrambler was a sort of small and convoluted roller coaster, only he kept calling it the Caterpillar. In reality, the Scrambler really exists, but my dream version of it was slightly different, making, I think, for a longer ride. Lots longer. Anyway, I had trouble convincing the ticket woman that Bra was the right age to ride for free, while Dad looked on. I plowed through my wallet, looking for my brother's birth certificate, knowing it wouldn't be there, finding all kinds of other irrelevant crap instead, doing this slow burn, but somehow managing to keep my temper anyway. The woman finally let us both go on the ride and actually praised me for showing so much patience. The ride itself was uneventful, except that there were people loitering on the track who kept having to scramble out of our way. I remember wondering if that was supposed to be part of the ride. When the ride was over, Bra wanted to go on it again and immediately hopped into the very last seat. Somehow the next seat was too small for me and the rest were taken, so I sat this one out. My father and I lounged near the ticket booth watching Bra's progress above. From the ground there was a point where the Scrambler cars disappeared from sight behind something. Oddly enough, on this occasion they never reappeared. The ride was then searched thoroughly, but the cars and their occupants were gone. I don't know if the park made any kind of financial settlement for survivors of the lost riders, I also don't know if my father and I ever discussed the whole tragic affair. What I know is this. From then on, every year, for as long as the park was open, the survivors of the vanished would gather at the Scrambler on what became known as Scrambler Day, as would the original operators of the ride. Everybody would assume their traditional old positions and wait endlessly, as if they really expected the Scrambler to finally come back. Naturally, we all aged, changed, and so forth. The original ticket woman now had a 20-year-old daughter with whom I was secretly in love with. Anyway, some 20 years or so after the disappearance, I was sitting there covertly eyeing the daughter and also watching what looked to be a whole chapter of VFWs staggered beerily around the area when suddenly, without warning, the Scrambler came back in. Everyone was all right. Everyone was the same age as when they'd started out. My brother was still a little kid. Everyone was sort of confused. Even I was confused, but I began advancing a number of scientific, pseudoscientific, and even science fictional theories that might serve to somehow explain the phenomena. But it turned out that good old Brother Bra was unable to help with these attempted explanations at all. To him and to other passengers, the ride had seemed uneventful, lasting the normal time, about 5 minutes at the most. 2. Interlude, The Riddle of Don Juan. One favorite theory of mine about the preceding events held that the Scrambler had somehow exceeded the speed of light or gone through an unexpected time warp or something and emerged in the future. I also theorized that alien life forms, like the space people in Close Encounters or of any other stamp, had perhaps kidnapped everybody, examined them, carefully brainwashed them to get them to forget the matter, and then returned them, not realizing how much time had passed on this plane or in this dimension. I also wondered if age was a factor. How many of the vanished had ridden for free? Bruh was so hot to reject these theories that I wondered as well if he and his companions had been replaced by aliens or by robots. Another theory concerned magic, I guess, and somehow led me into a long and complicated round of speculations about Don Juan, both the Yaqui wise man and the famous philanderer. Various legends, random bits of information, and even musical pieces floated through my head. While awake, I had once read a comic book which remarked that Casanova was just another way to say Newcastle. And so for a moment now, I equated Don Juan with Casanova, reputed to be an occult dabbler when his pants were on, and thus became half convinced that I could solve the riddle by traveling to Newcastle. I also considered seeking the answer by listening to a library tape I had of Mozart's Don Giovanni. Actually, I didn't even have the tape in my dream. So you can see I was pretty mixed up about things, but one tape I did have at hand in my dream was the Broadway production of The Phantom of the Opera, so I started listening to that, and then while the Don Juan triumphant riff was playing merrily away in the background of my dream, it suddenly occurred to me that I could probably figure everything out if I only had some crack. I've never done any crack. Apart from glimpses in the media, I've never even seen cocaine in that form. But I was reasonably certain that one dose would explain everything. And though I didn't know where to find a crack house, I did know from occasionally watching the news in real waking life where to go looking for one. I would go where all the rock heads hung out. Yes, it would now be necessary to make an expedition to Little Detroit. 3. Little Detroit, editor's note. Little Detroit is or was a nickname given by police and news media to an area on the east side of Columbus, I think, near Lincoln Park, I think, which is or was at this time considered to be the crack capital of Columbus. As it happens, I know somebody who lives or used to live out that way, a cute couple named Hildred and the Dragon Lady. I don't suspect them of being mixed up in the crack biz or of being rockheads, as the cops sometimes say about addicts. But in my dream, I figured these two might be a likely source of information. In my dream, I wound up with little or no effort right outside the house of Hildred and the Dragon Lady. It wasn't where it really is, but seemed rather to be a mixture of places. The street itself was indistinguishable from North 4th Street. For some reason, I was hesitant to knock, afraid, I think, that the zone witch might show up and catch me at this particular errand. I liked the zone witch. I even loved her. But she had dominion over me in this dream, and I didn't want her snooping around any crack deal I might get to make. I especially didn't want her to start calling me a rockhead. I knew she'd be making an appearance sooner or later, and I wanted it to be when I looked like I might just be hanging nonchalantly around Little Detroit for no particular reason at all. I just wished to hell she'd blow in and get it over with. To kill time, I started playing with Mutt and Jeff. This was a dog and cat combo that hung around outside the house. The dog's name was Jeff. In the dream, I felt they were pets of Hildred's, but in reality, these two animals enjoy no corresponding existence. I think I just made them up to amuse me while I tried to outfox the zone witch. These animals had one trick. The cat would put his head in the dog's mouth, like a lion tamer, and the dog would put up with it. They did it again and again. Somewhere along the line, the zone witch did show up, appearing, as usual, out of thin air. Naturally, she wanted to know what I was doing there. I thought of trying to explain to her about Don Juan and the Scrambler fiasco. "Look," I began tersely, "this is really an important mission I'm on." But then I thought better of it and just mumbled, "Actually, I forget, or rather, not much, I guess. Hey, have you seen this cat put his head..." But then I just trailed off. I used to live here once, she said, and disappeared, as was her wont. I noticed lights on now in the house. Muttering under my breath, I knocked, and the Dragon Lady promptly opened the door. At that exact moment, the Zone Witch was there again, this time flanked by two of her cohorts, Sister Kodiak and Madame Torquemada, a local journalist. I felt as if I were caught in the act, pants down, in front of witnesses. "Jesus wept," I ejaculated. "Listen, all I'm doing is hanging nonchalantly around Little Detroit for no particular reason at all, and now I can't even..." She cut me off abruptly with a nod to her lieutenants. "I'll see you at home, Rocky," she grated, as Sister Kodiak leered. With that, they were gone. The Dragon Lady, who'd been standing there with the door open, was just inviting me in when I woke up. Editor's note: the comic book reference in the interlude section was from John Constantine, Hellblazer, number 11, November 84, page 24, written by Jamie Delano, illustrated by, wait a minute, Richard Piers Rayner, and Mark Buckingham. Copyright 1988 by DC Comics. Editor's note from Goblin Hood. That was November 1988, not 84. But you can tell from that last little squib that it's extremely difficult to read some of this stuff in the newsletter because it's reduced so small. And that was an extremely good series for a while, that comic book series. But I'll talk about that at some later date, if I do it at all. Meanwhile, I want to go on with some of the other stories. This next piece was such a favorite dream of Beatty's that it found its way into the novel. Called Goblin Hood Satyricon. It's from a section in Beatty's Americana, Volume 1, Number 11, entitled The Expert Dreamer, which includes journal entries and dream stories. And one of the journal entries comments that, interestingly, a textbook says concerning dreams that if you don't wake up within 10 minutes of a dream, you won't remember it. The information was from page 107 of Time Presents, the Rand McNally Atlas of the Body, copyright 1980, by Rand McNally and Company. So part of the dream was based on that. The dream took place Monday, October 17th, 1988, at 9:10 a.m. And there's an editor's note. For what it's worth, the following dream took place during a period where I spent a lot of my time pondering the weird religious beliefs of Zeta Reticuli, as discussed on a TV special about ufology. Family matters. Or Fools Die on the Launch Pad, with apologies to Mario Puzo. Part 1, Afternoon, Joshua. It was afternoon, a fine fall day in early November. It was cool and crisp. Orange and brown leaves were falling all over the backyard where I was helping an old man putter and tinker with cars. The old man's young grandchild was there as well, scrambling about, trying to help. There were at least two cars being messed around with. One was an old DeSoto, circa 1959, and the other a considerably newer car. We seemed to be moving parts from one to the other of these or something, rather absurdly and inexplicably. For some reason, I was reminded of seedy defense contractors building a dubious joke of a rocket ship for NASA and the Pentagon. When I'm awake, by the way, cars bore the living hell out of me. Somewhere in through here, the grandchild lost an important car part or something. The energetic little scamp was in and out of both cars most of the time, capering merrily about, generally getting in the way, but still having a jolly, grandfatherly sort of an afternoon with the old man. I found time to think about how nice it was for these two to be spending a little time together. The old man was getting on in years, and I knew that he wouldn't get to spend much time on active duty as a grandfather before old age carried him away. I guess I went into a brown study of some sort then, and fell to pondering family relationships in general. This led to a consideration of the most famous case of child abuse and neglect in the Bible, the story of Joshua. Actually, in my waking mind, I know very little about his story. In my dream, though, it seems Joshua was one of those kids who got extremely kicked around by his family, like Joseph, I think. Eventually, I guess he even got sold into slavery, and yet he went on to order the sun to halt in its progress around the earth during the famous Battle of Jericho. I believe that last bit is according to real scripture. Whatever the real story was, this dream version asserted ex cathedra, as it were, somehow impressed me a lot. Local boy makes good, I more or less thought, and began mentally humming the old familiar tune, Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho, Jericho. Part 2, Night. This message brought to you by Jericho. Looks like a segue here. I guess a lot of time must have passed while I was in the Brown study. In any event, the afternoon passed away, and I suppose the old man did too, or at least he went away. Now it was late at night, and it might have been a million years later. I was in an enormous room whose entire floor was one huge mattress. On a nearby television set, I was watching a late-night movie hosted by an owl in sunglasses. For some reason, though, it seemed more like an afternoon-type movie. Surrounding me on the gargantuan mattress was a huge throng of women, a group that I have since come to think of as the Sisterhood Union. This mob included virtually every woman that I've ever been in love with or seriously cared about. It was sort of like a gigantic group marriage. They were all married to each other, and I was there as a kind of a mascot. In my dream, they all got along famously with one another, and they sort of tolerated me collectively and liked me to one extent or another as individuals. I don't know if any of them were ever in love with me, but they were capable of treating me with warmth and compassion. Quite a few of them seemed to be in love with each other. If I had any children with this bunch, I suppose they were all safely tucked away in some huge nursery room or something. The Sisterhood Union sort of scared me, if only because there were so many of them, but they also inspired me with awe. I regarded them as angelic beings, near godlike compared to the shabby likes of me. At any given time, there were usually a few of them who were more willing to put up with me than the others, and with these I tended to spend most of my time. I was with two of them now, near the television. They were a heartbreakingly beautiful pair whose names were Samothrace and Saint Hawk. Their attitude towards me was mostly one of genial indulgence, though they often tried to persuade me to quit smoking cigarettes. Both were dedicated non-smokers. Oddly, more than half of the women in the room were wearing identical bright orange t-shirts bearing some type of printed four-cornered motif. This symbol appeared to combine something about super string theory with whatever the good side is to drug abuse. It turned out that they had all been, that afternoon, to a special one-time-only community festival held to celebrate the birth or death of some major counterculture figure. Saint Hawk described this person as a great super genius, sort of a cross between Albert Einstein and Janis Joplin. It was all pretty confusing, so I soon found my attention wandering to the movie that was on television. The film's plot gradually became clear. Unethical defense contractors were building unsafe space vehicles with shoddy substandard parts and endangering lives. At the end, during the launch, the rocket got successfully away. But the gantry, instead of doing whatever it was supposed to do, literally fell apart, hurling frantic ground crew personnel to a falling, fiery demise. As the cops moved in to bust the crooks responsible, the credits flashed across the screen. The movie was called Fools Die. Hey, I know that title. I babbled to St. Hawk and Samothrace. I think it's a book by Mario Puzo, who wrote The Godfather. Geez, I never knew it was about this stuff. I'll have to read it. St. Hawk commented that she had heard of it too and added that the author had won some kind of award for his books. Soon a commercial or something came on the screen and I lost interest. St. Hawk and Samothrace were talking about the festival again, and I still couldn't figure out whose honor it had been held in. But a strange thing started happening just then. Though everyone in the room was fully clothed, we were all lying half under this huge blanket, which covered the mattress. Now, as these two women talked, one of them began to stroke my hand under the blanket with her toes in a distinctive, repetitious pattern. It didn't seem sensual, but seemed to convey some urgency. It reminded me a little of Kurt Vonnegut's Bocanonist ritual from the book Cat's Cradle, but it also seemed more pointed. I became extremely sensitive to this weird routine, realizing that it was a message of some importance being delivered in a tactile form of Morse code. Concentrating hard, I finally deciphered the message, a communique from the entire sisterhood union. They were saying, "Don't be afraid of us. We are your friends." The message was repeated over and over, like a radio message being beamed to or from outer space. While this was still going on, Samothrace asked me in normal human tones, verbal mode, if I would go out to the store and get her and St. Hawk a pack of cigarettes. I guess that's what clued me that I was dreaming, realizing that I only had 10 minutes to wake up if I wanted to record this dream and the message intact, as opposed to the sort of garbled version I have of the earlier segment. I got out of the huge bed and left the room, heading not for the store, but for the world of waking reality. My journey back to full consciousness was not unlike negotiating a long series of dimly lit hallways, each of which had slightly better lighting, until I finally reached a bright chamber called the Opening of the Eyes. And so I left them there, probably forever, in order to bring me their urgent message. Don't be afraid of us. We are your friends. And it sometimes seems to me that the whole world is constantly saying that to me for various nefarious purposes. But only in a case like this am I willing to listen uncritically, no matter what they have in mind. My family right or wrong. I only wish I could find my way back there. And I can't help wondering who the festival was for. Editor's note. For anyone who is interested, the UFO program mentioned earlier aired on Channel 28 in Columbus Friday, October 14th, 1988, circa 9 p.m. That was the day I finished a painting entitled Vim, Vigor, and Vortex. On the program, government agents claimed that the United States government is the host of visitors from Zeta Reticuli, who have a secret base in Nevada. These aliens are said to be very fond of strawberry ice cream. Supposedly, the extraterrestrials subscribe to what is called a universal religion. They believe that the universe itself is a supreme being. Oddly, that's what I believe as well. Editorial note from Goblinhood. Zeta Reticuli is also the focus of the aliens in the story Interrupted Journey, which is a famous UFO story made into a film during the 70s, I think. So, and the secret base is probably talking about Area 51. Anyway, I'm going to go on for as long as I've got the time here. This story is also from the Lyceum 23 book, Desire is Illusion. Pete's Conquest of the Universe, A Struggle for Absolute Power by James Beattie, 1991, read by Goblin Hood. I'd say that it began in the park, but these things never really begin anywhere, nor do they ever really end. But I guess you could say that certain parts of them are finite, though you could probably say the same about anything. Lyceum 23 was supposed to be meeting in the park unless it rained. Kimmy had told me this on the phone a day or so before. It was a rare meeting when the proposed meeting site didn't get changed at least once. This time even the day and hour had been changed. Meanwhile, all things considered, meeting in the park was a good way to make it rain. But this time it couldn't decide whether to actually rain or not. I guess it just didn't want to be pushed around. Anyway, a bunch of us showed up in the park, but we were the only ones who did. The many others, we all decided, must have gone to the alternate meeting site in case of rain. That, we all agreed, was usually Delia and Jim's house, but nobody in the park seemed to think they were home. Nobody seemed to be wrong about them being home, or right, or whatever it was. They weren't home, though we knocked, even though going so far as to use the official door knocker. The rest of the people at the meeting hadn't shown up either, just us, the park people. But Pete was there, watching us closely from the open but screened window upstairs in front, and occasionally whining in a mildly agitated fashion. Pete was Mary Jo's dog, who was staying with Delia and Jim while Mary Jo was out of town. It later turned out they were in a movie, so Pete was in charge of the house in their absence. Pete seemed both happy and sad to see us. Happy to see us, but sad that he couldn't invite us in and display his keen sense of hospitality. He was only staying there for a few days, but he seemed more than willing to disregard this mere detail and maybe even break out the champagne. After knocking pointlessly for a while, we started speculating in regards to everybody else's whereabouts. I offered the theory that they, unlike us, really were all at the meeting, which really was at this location, but in a parallel universe, meaning, of course, that we had all just crossed over into the Twilight Zone, etc. Privately, I entertained the notion that everyone except Pete had been quietly and mysteriously kicked out of Lyceum 23 without us even being told. The big problem with that idea was the well-known saying that everyone is a member of Lyceum 23, meaning presumably everyone in the universe, which would have made it a lot easier to have simply kicked Pete alone out of this free-form group of performance artists. And if that had been the case, then why was Pete the only one present at the quasi-official meeting site? The answer may have been that this site was only official if it actually rained. And so far, only a few maverick drops had actually fallen from a sullen sky that, on the whole, petulantly refused to go ahead and actually rain, which left us in a kind of gray area because it left open the possibility that by now there might actually be a real meeting of sorts going on back in the park, even without having to take place in a parallel universe. In any case, we all knew that this was the real and official meeting, and we decided to hold it in front of the house as if daring the rain to try and do anything about it, which would have forced us to finish the real and official meeting in Mark's van. We knew it would take guts to do it this way, but we had guts, which was more than could be said for the big, bad, scary rain. It had finally given up and decided to call the whole thing off, leaving us in a situation where we might have been better off in the park. In fact, who knew for sure that being back at the park might not actually have changed all of our lives forever. It was a scientific fact, after all, that being here had, in fact, changed all of our lives forever, sending us down a divergent probability line in which the meeting, the real official meeting, took place here and not in the park or in Timbuktu or on the naked surface of the sun or in the dressing room of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. Still, you had to draw the line somewhere. And so this was where we drew the line, here at the real official Lyceum 23 meeting in front of the real official house where we were supposed to have met. By imperial order of the goddamn fucking rain, which could never have been prevailed upon to just leave us the hell alone, but which had very suspiciously decided, for reasons of its own, that we were not privileged to know about, to just leave us alone anyway. The rain, of course, which was collectively made up of billions of living beings called microorganisms and bacteria, was technically collectively also a member of Lyceum 23, but not, at this moment, a member in very good standing, and not, for that matter, a member present at the real official and genuine meeting. Anyway, this was where we met, at this near approximation of the actual alternative location, with Pete looking on through the upstairs window, just as though he had been kindly reinstated in the group for this occasion, instead of being the only real member of the group left on the planet, or at least the highest life form present at the truly real and official and genuine original alternative meeting site. In all, he seemed to be wearing his position of vast responsibility rather well, but I couldn't help wondering if he were watching us so closely because we were a bunch of people that he knew, or if he would have been watching any bunch of people in front of the house just as avidly. Then, too, he may have been guarding the house, or even just staring off into space. These Lyceum 23 meetings are getting more and more surreal all the time, I told myself as we sat there, both defying and simultaneously obeying the harsh dictates and whims of the almighty rain, which seemed at this point to have virtually established itself as the supreme commander-in-chief of our all-encompassing group. But I supposed we could always tell ourselves that we were meeting here for Pete, so that he could be at the meeting too, instead of having to just hear about it later on. In any case, there we sat, Kathy, Kimmy, Mark, Michelle, Liz, Mel, and me, with Pete's earnest face gazing steadfastly down upon us from on high, wondering where Tyler was, and patiently waiting for the sound of Gary's van to signal his usual late arrival so that we'd know when it was time for the meeting to just about be over. Meanwhile, I was secretly wondering if our next meeting could take place in front of the lobster tank at Kroger's, so that we could get a lobster perspective on things and solicit their input, and otherwise pretend that they too were members of Lyceum 23 and not just a bunch of doomed losers and entrees. Interestingly, this meeting was where Michelle proposed the swell idea of preparing a Lyceum 23 book for the ComFest, which started me thinking about writing this stirring saga all down. But how to thicken the plot, I wondered. Suddenly, at that very moment, back at the park, the rain continued not to fall, goading the park into considering the idea of writing a letter of resignation from its membership in Lyceum 23 on the grounds of its unfair rejection as the original official site for any meeting that took place in the absence of rain. Would the park, this collection of life forms, get over its artistic, egotistic little snit and retain its membership? That's a story for another time, but it sure added a hint of zest and suspense to this one, right? And meanwhile, back at the real, official, genuine, and authentic original alternative site of the Lyceum 23 meeting, Pete, the true supreme commander-in-chief of this celebrated freeform and all-encompassing performance group, the ruler by extension of the entire universe, the only member of the group, in fact, who had shown up at the correct time and exactly the right place for the meeting, the only real, official, genuine, authentic, and bona fide member of Lyceum 23 in the world at that moment, unless you count any other pets, plants, microbes, furnishings, or the apartment itself. That is to say, Pete, the dog, this near godlike being, watched the jolly crew of hapless pretenders cavorting and capering about outside, and generously, magnanimously decided, in his wisdom, to include them in these important deliberations, despite their presence at the wrong place, technically at the right time. I suppose you're all wondering why I've asked you here today, began the most powerful entity in the universe in a telepathic manner of speaking, and this was only the beginning. A note from Goblinhood here. This month, March of 1999, at the current location of the Acme Art Company, Mary Jo Bowl has a front window installation centering around her dog, Pete, who's still going strong. And I, Goblinhood, saw her at the opening for this show and had to remind her of this story about Pete in the old Lyceum 23 book. She said she'd go home and read it. I wanted her to know that Pete's been a big star for some of us for a long time. Since I've got a little tape left, I'm going to read a very short story. Another dream story. This one from Fiati's Americana, Volume 1, Number 4. And this story, I hope it's self-explanatory, but it's got a lot of history behind it and involves the crack-up of the big Soviet Union. Anyway, it's called Guilt-Free Needles. There's no date, but it's called Guilt-Free Needles, a dream news story by James Beattie. Remember Christmas Day, 1989, when the so-called death of the Antichrist was reported. They announced the execution of Romanian dictators and mass murderers Nicolae Ceaușescu and wife after a secret trial. But no news flash I caught that day could tell me how they died. That night, I dreamed the execution. I'd suspected they'd been shot. That seemed the most official and the most likely method. But in my dream, they were killed by lethal injection. It was a pretty strange setup. The condemned wore weird armbands with four holes in each one. These were then penetrated by a species of injection gun utilizing four hypodermic needles. Oddly though, only one of the needles contained anything lethal, sort of like the legendary one blank cartridge reported to be included in a conventional military firing squad. That way, I guess, only one of the needles had to feel guilty. More Goblinhood commentary here. Apparently that was the date. It was Christmas Day, 1989. The headline of this little story is a neat picture of Ceaușescu getting it in the arm with some kind of a little buzzing needle machine. The headline in full read, Guilt-Free Needles, a sticky problem solved. But my dream was, geez, I mean, the dream was actually a piece of cake compared to the reality, because it turned out later reports mentioned Ceaușescu. This is in reality now. Romania was one of the communist countries, ex-Soviet countries, to fall the hardest, because Ceaușescu had been one of the worst of the dictators or something. It mentioned him and his wife being chased through the streets and shot at, apparently basically just like clubbed to death by a mob or something. I don't really know how it happened. The report that, but I mean, that's very strongly in my mind that there were reports like that of a really brutal end to the dictator and his wife. This is the guy that had a whole clinic full of children dying of AIDS for some reason. I don't know what he thought he was doing. Maybe he was just isolating them. This is also the dictator who, though he was a staunch Soviet supporter, he took time off to help celebrate the historic anniversary or something of Vlad the Impaler, because that's whose country Vlad basically was part of. Wallachia, I guess, was part of Romania at the time. Anyway, of all the former Soviet countries that fell during the early 90s or the late 80s, Romania was the one that, like I said, fell hardest. And this little lethal injection scenario was the merest love tap compared to the way they really dealt with their former dictator, who probably deserved every bit of it, you know. I mean, I'm not saying he didn't, but I'm saying that, gee, it's good that the needles got to not feel guilty, sort of like a firing squad, you know. So meanwhile, that's pretty much it for this tape, and that's pretty much it for all of the tapes so far to date. This one was taping over something that I have a master copy of that I hope I'll be able to tape again. And one thing I should mention is that the mysterious Martian Sphinx mentioned in the Lovecraftian story has since been sort of exploded by more recent NASA photographs. The most recent photographs supposedly show the area is looking a lot like a parking lot, but it looks, you know, or just a big plain of rubble, but it also looks suspiciously like something from which a huge monumental face had recently been scraped away, as if the Martians didn't want us to verify that little secret of theirs one way or the other. I recently had a library book called Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever. I forget who wrote the book. I was going to read excerpts of that onto a tape, but they were so, the book was out of date. It was a few years back before the most recent probes. Now I've got like 3D photographs of the surface of Mars that I can play with and look at. The actual picture of the area in Cydonia where the Sphinx is supposed to be, though, I don't know if I've got a copy of that picture or not. And I don't know if I trust what NASA said about it. They were chirping too loudly about having scotched that story for good. So that may be what they were actually trying to do, was just show a picture of rubble and say there is no Sphinx.